Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
Hello, this is Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure, and I'm spending time with a couple of partners from Anarchist Wine Company, Steve Ryan and Patrick Sabo. And we're going to get to know them personally and professionally. So let's start with Steve.
Hi.
Tell us about your background. Yes, hello.
My background goes way back to college, where I got into home brewing with some friends and ended up deciding brewing was where I wanted to go. Ended up transferring schools, changing my major to get into fermentation science, and finished up at going to Davis after that for brew school, basically, in fermentation science and engineering, and then worked for Gordon Biersch for a long time, local or regional brewery out here in the West, and was there for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, and then through some different kind of course of action, ended up kind of stumbling into real estate and development, and went down that path for a while, got burned out on brewing. And then a friend of mine, when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next, this was in 2010, because the Giants were in the playoffs and Tim Lincecum was pitching an awesome game against the Braves, where he struck out some awesome, like 14 people, and they won like 1-0 or 2-1 or something like that. And we were at Kezar Pub in the city, and a buddy and I were talking. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And he said, well, ever since you were brewing, you always said you wanted to get into wine and you really enjoyed it. And you've got the fermentation background, you've got the business acumen from dealing with the development stuff. And, you know, I think it seems like it would be a good fit. And I was like, you're right. I do want to get into wine. I forgot about that.
It's like a Jedi mind trick almost.
Right? It totally is. And because I had completely forgotten. And then I decided, you know, the next day I went home, got my resume together, geared it more towards that avenue of profession, and went on to winejobs.com and started applying for pretty much everything that was not a seller position, just because I definitely had done that in my brewing days. And after probably 70 different submissions for various different jobs, I finally got one call from Crushpad for the non-paid work for 10 cases of wine for 6 months internship.
You just made so many people feel so much better.
I hope so.
I think there's a lot of us that are applying for a lot of different jobs and getting rejected left and right. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely a wee bit humbling. And I also think that at least, you know, 60 or maybe 55 of those people just were not good hiring managers, clearly, and that they just totally passed on true raw talent.
Well, but sorry now.
But yeah, so I took an internship, you know, working. It was supposed to work for 10 cases of wine, and for Crushpad, which at the time they were in Sonoma. They were just moving to Sonoma when I started, and it was a company that started in San Francisco. They kind of really started this idea of making custom wines by the barrel for people. And really, I mean, super cool business model, super cool ideas, great products, and really kind of fantastic marketing minds that were doing it. And then shortly after I got there, the company was just kind of running into some hurdles. And long story short, there was a turnover with the executive team, and the new CEO that came in thought that I knew what I was doing on some things, and so he kind of promoted me up pretty quickly from intern to I guess vice president. And
wow, that's a meteoric rise.
Yeah.
Just about.
I mean, it's kind of a dubious honor having that role, though, because shortly after we both kind of went into those roles, realized the company was in trouble, and I didn't realize it at the time because I wasn't privy to a handful of stuff, but Company ended up going basically insolvent and went through a process similar to a bankruptcy. And there was a kind of Hail Mary investor that was brought in to be kind of an equity infuser at sort of the 11th hour. And he came in, started doing due diligence for a couple weeks. And he really liked the model. He really liked some of the people, but did not think that the business without a lot of changes was really something that could go forward. And so, but he and I and Patrick had gotten to know each other pretty well throughout that due diligence process. And because Patrick was also there with me, he'll fill you in later. But so we basically kicked around some ideas of how to turn the business into a profitable thing, or the model, I should say. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of waited, and the business went up at auction. All the assets went up at auction, and we grabbed them and formed the Wine Foundry the next day. So I've been here now for, we just had our 7th anniversary. We're going into our 8th harvest. And so I guess been in the wine industry now 8 years, 9th harvest for me. And it's been a fun ride. It's awesome. So that's kind of my background there.
Well, Crushpad was such a hub for a lot of wine nerds and people in the know and people that has fallen in love with the business. So it's interesting to hear the backstory of, you know, there's a bit of a phoenix bird rising from the ashes happening.
Totally. And it was, so I made wine at Crushpad actually with a group of friends. I think 07, 08, and 09, or 08, 09, and 10, maybe. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of our partners who also worked at Crushpad, who was the guy that hired me as an intern, he was very hesitant to hire me because I had been a client, and I think I had addressed that in my cover letter or whatever. But yeah, it was an awesome, awesome, cool thing, especially in San Francisco, and just kind of really bring in amazing fruit that nobody else could get access to, you know, to the masses, to be able to make wine by committee or to do their own thing and to start and incubate small brands. So it was a great model.
Do you think went wrong fundamentally, just like helicopter view?
At Crushpad?
Yeah.
I think that there were some brilliant marketing and product minds. Mm-hmm. And I would say probably just operations of the business, the fixed costs were really, really high. You know, one of the big changes we made was, you know, they would do everything in tea bins, and so bins that hold 1 ton of fruit, or mm-hmm. really if you're fermenting in them, like 3/4 of a ton or so. And so they could have like 400 or 500 ferments going at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of people that are sampling and testing and you know, all of that, and labor is obviously such a big part of the fixed costs, as well as space to do that.
Sure.
And you're paying San Francisco real estate, or eventually Napa briefly, and then Sonoma. But so when one of the things we changed was to make things and do primary fermentation together in one lot in tank, and so we'll do, you know, 10 tons or 12 tons of something, and then once we go down and barrel it down, then we assign it to our clients. And they still, it's not a homogenized product. They still get very, very different wines and very customized for them. But, you know, at the end of the day, you make better wine in tanks. You can control a lot more variables. And it helps to fix costs because we can have, you know, 60 ferments a harvest instead of, you know, whatever, 400 or, you know, whatever it may be.
Of course.
Yeah.
Got it. Interesting. So we turn to you, Steven. We know that...
Patrick,
I'm sorry.
No problem. That's okay. It's been a long day.
Yes, it has. So you guys met at Crushpad then?
We did. Okay. Yeah, I was working at Crushpad already when he implied to be the intern, for a marketing intern. So I had been making wine. I started Crushpad in 2010, when they moved to Napa, actually, in 2010. They had just moved from... in San Francisco. They started in 04, 05, I think, and were in a couple of places in the city. And then after 08 and 09 harvest particularly, they really kind of grew too much. And at the same time as the economy is pulling back, it was just part of the kind of bad timing and kind of and a few other things as well. I had a couple of quality issues and things that logistics of, as Steve mentioned, is the logistics of making hundreds of wines at the same time are significant and they're not to be trifled with, and we're underappreciated how difficult that is. And mm-hmm. it is a very, very difficult to do that particular business model. And so there's just no margin for error at all. And so that is very, very hard with thin margins and no margin for error. That makes not for, I think, for, it makes for difficult. And so, yes, we met then. And so I'd been making wine since I moved out here in 2000 to actually in one more month, it'll be our 23rd wedding anniversary. And we came out on September 22nd. We got married. Of 96, and we were getting ready to then we came out here for 8 days, and it was harvest time of 96, and I'd been a waiter for 7 years at that point and fell in love with wine, mostly because I made more money the more I knew about wine, and the more wine I sold, it benefited me for selfish reasons. I definitely wanted to, but I just fell in love with tasting the mid-90s of in Napa. Kind of like the run we've had in the last 7-8 years here in Napa is almost unprecedented. It's really just incredible quality across the board. You can go to so many different producers and get wines that'll just blow you away. And as a wine lover, and I said my background is in it's primarily consumption, and so I've been a big wine lover for a long time. And even when I was selling,
most important part.
Of course, and it's the. And so I think I might have a PhD in consumption, and I'm still learning how to produce it, you know. And it, but just drew me. I had unfortunately played a. I wasn't a very good student in my first attempt at college, and I was an excellent socializer, but not so good at attending class. And so I tried for a couple years at the College of Charleston, where I'm from, Charleston, South Carolina, mm-hmm. and I. Made the mistake of trying to go to school in town, and it didn't work very well for me. I didn't go to a lot of those classes, and then I realized that I very quickly that I needed to take a break and regroup. My brother had an idea of starting a business. We started, it was a barter exchange actually. We bartered, bought a franchise of a company that's based out of Burbank, California, and we started a company, a barter exchange, but we started with no capital, so I had to wait tables. I had to keep my night job, which was a waiter, and so I worked 7 to 3 in the office, and then I would put on my waiter uniform and then work 4 to 10
at a pretty killer restaurant too.
At a really cool restaurant, yeah. And quickly burning the candle on both sides, though. I met my wife at the restaurant, and we had our first daughter Maddie in October of 95, so she'll be 24 and a couple months, and then 11 months later we got married and we came out here on our honeymoon so that mom could enjoy the honeymoon also. And I just fell in love with it. And when we got on the plane, I remember looking back over at my wife and said, I want to go to school for making wine. And she was kind of like, well, okay, you know, that's fine. She had moved down to Charleston from Columbus, Ohio, where she was from. And Charleston was a bit more, in South Carolina in general, was a bit more conservative than what she was hoping to be mm-hmm. anyway. So California sounded great to her, and we loved the weather that we were out here, and everything seemed kind of perfect. So I decided right then I wanted to sell the company and go back to school and start over again. I was thinking probably more like this, like we're doing now, getting ready to do now, enjoying, sitting around talking about wine and tasting wine together. Not really chemistry, biology, and biochemistry and microbiology, organic chemistry, those types of things. I really wasn't thinking about winemaking. I was thinking of wine drinking. And so then necessarily winemaking. There's a lot of winemaking that has to happen before, of course, you can get to the wine drinking, which is really important. And so I had to start over again.
What's important, the wine drinking or the winemaking?
They're both. Unfortunately, winemaking is important if you want to get to wine drinking. And you got to, someone's got to be making it. So I... started over again and started taking chemistry classes and organic chemistry and microbiology and biochem and all the fun prerequisites that are necessary to get into days and apply to UC Davis. And I got in and we moved out here in 2000, and I graduated 2 years later at the tender age of 31 So it's never too late to get your degree. So that was a fun, and I it was people when I came back from my honeymoon, I said I'm gonna become a winemaker. Everyone was like, "No, you're not." I'm like, well, why not? Like, what are you gonna do? Like, I'm like, I'm gonna go to school for it. You can't do that. I'm like, yes, you can. So you can go to UC Davis. You can go to these other classes. You know. And people thought I was literally crazy, like I'd been drinking too much wine while I was out here. And I didn't, I'm like, well, people that are winemakers that are currently doing it, they had to learn how to do it too. And they, so I was determined, and there you go. We moved out and graduated in 2002. And
pretty supportive wife, Donna.
Very supportive.
Very impressive
spouse. Yeah. She had already had 2 children at the time. We actually had our son at 2 weeks after I graduated. So he just turned 17 a couple weeks back. And so we have a 20, or soon to be 24, a 20-year-old and a 17-year-old. And we did it the hard way, that we moved out here without any degrees. Neither one of us had a degree. And we went back to school, and I graduated first. And then she went back to school. Then she went and got a master's too after that. So you can definitely start over and regroup. And if you're determined and you work hard, you can do it. And so
you really wanted it, didn't you?
I did. I really wanted to. You know, I don't want to make you too sad, but my father passed away, unfortunately, in a scuba diving accident at 49 years old, back in March of 1987, mm-hmm. March 10th. So I'll be 49 in just a few months, and so it's very prescient to me. And when I was out here, and I hadn't graduated college, I was a little bit embarrassed that I felt like I was not doing very much with my being a good waiter, and is a fine career choice, but it didn't satisfy me enough. I wanted more. I felt it was a little bit. I felt underwhelming, or under mm-hmm. you know under
stimulated.
Under accomplished, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit embarrassed about that. And so it wasn't just to try to help my ego, although some of it I'm sure was for that purpose, but I just wanted to feel like I was living my life for selfish reasons for myself, and was doing what I wanted to do, not because I had to do it. I started going into school for computers or something else, finance or some law or something to make money. And it would have been smarter probably financially to do it that way, but that's not what I wanted to do. And so I changed my mind. I decided I want to do what I want to do, not what I have to do. So I just went for it. And so this is what I wanted to do. And I just jumped, you know, and so it worked out. So it's not been easy though. I've been just complaining earlier too. I was interviewing someone for a position, and I was telling her how difficult it's been to get to this point. I've had to work. This is my 20th harvest coming up, mm-hmm. and even with plenty of enthusiasm and skill and attention to detail, you still have to earn it, and you have to really pay attention, and there's no guarantee. Nothing's guaranteed at all, and you have to hustle. It's winemaking is a lot of wine drinking is quite fun and takes very little skill to do so, but winemaking takes a lot of attention to detail. And much like brewing and cooking, you can get very good at it if you have the right logistics and materials and knowledge. And so it comes with hard work though, and for some luck. And timing is critical. You know, all the things that happen to make someone successful are all because of a bit of luck, a bit of hard work, a bit of insight and judgment. And so, you know, we started a company that is very ambitious. We make more wines, as far as I know, than anybody else in the world. And do it year after year after year after year. So it's pretty to make 200-400 wines per year is difficult to do. And so it's for anyone that's made wine, that's listening, that's made wine or tried to make wine at home, making one wine, you feel a lot of pressure and responsibility, and you multiply that out times 300 or 400, and you have you can get a sense of how grandiose that goal is. And so
I think you touched on it earlier too, when you maybe it was before we started recording, but you were saying there's literally zero margin of error, you know.
Yeah.
Like if we're for the Anarchist Wine Co. brand, when we do that, you're dealing with bigger lots and bigger caseloads and all of that. But when you're dealing with small, you know, 100 case lots or something like that,
or 25 case
lots, or 25 case lots, even, you know, then you
everything's really magnified. Yeah, everything. I was mentioning to my interviewee earlier, a woman that I was interviewing was that I was saying that everything is magnified. So when you make one barrel of wine, so we, the Anarchist Wine Company, is our brand that we produce for ourselves, but we make, I make many other wines for people that want to have their own brands, whether it's for their home, for their, just for their house, or it's for their, in their company's name, or it's for sale, or it's for some combination of those things. We make hundreds of different wines, mostly one barrel at a time, for people that live all over the place. And so you can live here, you can be here right in town in San Francisco, or you can be in Hong Kong, or you can be in Chicago, and you can be anywhere. And you can say, I want to have my own wine. And then we go out and you can say, okay, I'm trying to make a Cabernet, I'm trying to make a Pinot Noir, I'm trying to make a white blend, or whatever it is. And we source grapes and then we sell individual barrels and make individual barrels of wines for people. So that's another level of what we do. And so the when you're making a single barrel wine, it's one of one. It's one of one. It's not one of two or one of 100. We are, you know, so when you, if you make a very good barrel wine, 100% of that person's wine is excellent. If you fault, if you made any, if any mistakes at all, if there's any faults, if there's, then 100% of that wine shows that fault. And so it's very, you have a very, very, very sharp knife, I guess, to cut things with. And so a double edged and very, very sharp, as I mentioned, without any, or very little room to try to fix things. So
I just want to highlight something that it really is worth shining a spotlight on, and that is what you said about yourself. You said, well, some of it was about me. I think it really starts with you giving yourself a chance as an individual to express yourself. And you know, I hear that a lot from people that are very creative and very capable and very worth admiration. That theme tends to be recurring, is that you have to, at some point, it's not an age thing, it's when you're ready, give yourself an opportunity to say, what is it that I want from life? And it's hardly ever convenient. You know, you were in a situation when you had a baby, you had a young marriage, you had to support a family, I'm sure you felt a ton of pressure, and yet you deliberately decided, you know, at some point that switch flipped. This is what I want. This is right. How I want the rest of my life to look like. You
That's
owned
right.
it.
That's right. It was tough, you know. It was, and there were many, and there, as with most people's journeys, there are some difficult moments, and some that you look back on, you're like, wow, that wasn't easy at all. You know, coming out to California, which is much, much more expensive than South Carolina, without any, you know, and trying to start from with very little and without any. Resources or connections or any contacts out here or anything. We just totally kind of moving to out into, it's like moving out, you know, it does remind me a bit, although it was a bit more high tech, of wagoning out, you know, and just starting from scratch kind of thing. And so we, fortunately for me, thank you, Steve, for highlighting that. I have a partner that is, she, you know, supported me and us, not just me, but our kids and our family, that made it so that without that, you know, if I didn't have any type of means to start up out here, particularly in California and particularly in the Bay Area, it's incredibly difficult. And so it's been a hard road for sure. I have a lot of, particularly now that we do what we do, I said, I don't think anyone, as far as I know, has ever done what we're doing and or what I'm doing currently. And so the uniqueness of it certainly is—it's very, I guess, it's very sexy, you know, to try to charter a path that's never been chartered before. It's adventurous. It's nerve-wracking. You know, it's pressure. It's pressure-oriented. I have, as I mentioned, just to make you feel sorry for me, I have a... not going
to
work.
I have to jump out of that air. As I mentioned earlier, bottling is kind of like jumping off a cliff or jumping out of an airplane. I got to do that, you know, 2 to 5 times per day, 4 days a week, 8 months out of the year.
Yeah.
And so that gives you a sense of what that's like. That's a huge responsibility, and the pressure that comes with that is incredibly significant, and it's hard to appreciate that until you've been put in that position to do that yourself. I thought that I was pretty arrogant actually when I came to CrushPad. I thought that I'd already made wine in probably a dozen different facilities for a handful of different brands, and there are handfuls of brands, and I'd already had a pretty good amount of experience at that point, and I felt like I didn't need to be taught very much, I'd say. And so I quickly learned I was wrong, and making wine the way that we do currently and in the way we did at CrushPad is different than what a normal winemaker does. And so that a normal winemaker doesn't get that until she or he starts doing what we're doing. And so it's, you just don't know until you know. And so a lot of people, you know, I said, and now currently I've made wine in, I think it's not quite 20 different facilities now, 18 or 20 different places. But I've never made wine, you know, and any other brands that I've consulted for are done the way that we do it. And so it's not so much during fermentation, it's just the overall process and how we can fit it all in and the logistics of the whole facility and business. For anyone that's not done production, is super difficult. It doesn't stop. It keeps going. You don't get to stop because you want to rest or you want to turn off or shut down a little bit. You have to hit certain goals and target. If you're trying to bottle 300 wines per year and you have you have 8 months, that means you have to start doing the math on it and work backwards on it. You have to keep going. And so the end of the day is that to be going full time, and really the only time where we're not doing that is during harvest. So then you have to shift your goals towards focusing just on what it takes to make good wine. There are different skill sets that are hard to balance. It's just like life in general. It's really hard to be good at everything throughout life. You can be good at certain things, but you may not excel in all of them when you're trying to do well in everything to make it a perfectly balanced. And it's lofty goals. And that doesn't mean you shouldn't try to do it. It just, that's very difficult to do. And it ages you fast. And so I feel like we're probably 242 years old at this point, say through 8 harvests. Steve looks like he is, at least.
Well, that's the nice thing about working in kind of operations or kind of running the more business side of things, is that the winemaker gets either all the credit or all the blame for whatever happens with the end product. You know, like I can be behind the scenes. And so I would err on the side that I definitely look younger than you.
You are younger and you do look younger. You're right.
See, yep. You threw out some unicorns. Yeah, I'm still on 300-400 wines. That sounds like an urban myth to me almost.
It's hard to imagine. It really is.
It really is mind-blowing.
It's not something to recommend to anybody, I swear.
So how did we even come up with that?
Why that number?
What happened? So take me back to the beginning. So you get together, CrushPad, obviously, you know, you kind of reinvented it from what you described in terms of the custom crush, you know, such small clients especially. But how did you make a decision to actually start all those? You have 3 separate businesses. So
yeah, that's that great. Happen? Great call. Do you mind if I jump in?
Go for it.
All right. So, and I mean, first credit, you know, the folks that started CrushPad and kind of envisioned it and all of that, they actually did, you know, they were doing, you know, up to, I don't know, 600 different wines, 1 or 2 years or so. And
Even more.
Because when they first were, I think they were doing 800 to 1,000 barrels a year for like 07, 08, 09-ish, something like that. Before my time, at least working there, well before. But and so to how they did that, they definitely had more winemakers and more staff and all of that.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.